Welcome to season 4 of And the Writer Is. I am your host, Ross Golan. I've written with hundreds of artists and writers over the years, and my favorite part of each session is the first hour when we catch up about life, the industry, politics, composition, whatever. So this is a journey of learning why people write songs, how people write songs, and most importantly, who the people are who write the songs. I'm producing this with the great Joe London, Big Deal Music Publishing, and Mega House Music Management. If you want to listen to the songs we discuss in this podcast, follow us on our socials, find out about special events, or buy some of our merchandise, go to our website, www.andthewriteris.com. Oh, and if you enjoy And the Writer Is, please rate and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever your preferred podcast listening site is.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to And the Writer Is. I am your host, Ross Golan. Today's number one worldwide hit songwriter has written defining and redefining songs for artists like Rihanna, Pitbull, Fifth Harmony, and Kelly Clarkson. She's crossed genres from Miranda Lambert to Iggy Azalea and crossed generations from Madonna to Nick Jonas. But that's not all, folks. She's an award-winning independent artist who continues to write, record, and release music by her own rules. This Floridian is strong in her religious convictions and has integrity few people in our community have. There's always a kinship between writers signed not just to the same publishing company, but signed to the very same A&R. Shout out to Ryan Press. And the writer is my publishing sibling, Priscilla Renee.
Hola. Thank you for having me.
Hi.
That was an amazing intro, by the way. I'm like, oh, everything you say.
It's kind of exciting, right? But they're all true. It's all factual.
Oh, me? Is that me?
I know. Well, let's sort of figure out, because I've got a few things that are kind of fun to talk about as we go. But I just want to do like a little bit of the introduction. You know, how are we in the same room at the same time? And it starts with you and on YouTube in,
in the 2004.
2004, you're on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
So how does that get you to here?
You know, when you say it like that, it does sound pretty far-fetched. But back then, I just didn't have any other way of, I mean, you know, that was during the time that you had to like be on a TV show like American Idol, or you had to be in a bar and get discovered by an A&R. So when YouTube came along, it was like, aha, somewhere I can sing and somebody will see it. I don't know who it's going to be. And honestly, I just started out doing it as an outlet.
Were you writing before that? I mean, how?
Oh yeah, I've been writing songs since I was 8.
Since you were 8?
Oh yeah.
What's your first song?
Funny, I was vacuuming the floor and we're living in Jacksonville, Florida. I was 8 years old. And I just had this melody. It was like, walking down the highway, looking at the skyway. And my brother was like, what song is that? I'm like, I made it up. And he goes, no, you didn't. I'm like, yes, I did. So then he's like, Mom. So we go in the living room and I sing it for her. And she goes, this sounds like she made it up to me. I never heard it. And so, I mean, that was a thing in our house, though, where my mom would put on music and we would like freestyle over the top of it. So we would always take the words, the same melody, same kind of cadence.
All of you guys would do it?
In the car, yeah. That was just normal. That was something we would do.
Who started that?
My mom. She would just be like, okay, here we go. Rat, think, you stink. Tell me what you think is going on. And then we'd be like, I need a drink. I want it to be pink. You know, like we would just do that in the car.
Did she want to do music or she just naturally just loved music?
If I'm being honest, I think that's something that happens in Black culture a lot, in the Black community, freestyle. Like, somebody just starts it in the car. You know, your song comes on, you be like, check it. you just do it. It's not even, or like somebody will make a beat, start clapping, you know, lunch table, boom, 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 boom.
Yeah.
It just is a thing. But we would do it a lot in our car. Road trips, my dad was in the Navy, so we would drive from wherever we were at the time, which at this point was, when we used to do it a lot. We were living in Maryland and D.C., and we would drive down to Florida, which was like 14 hours. So we had different games we would play, you know, punch buggy.
Punch buggy. Yeah. Having your dad be in the military, was he creative, or was he strict? I mean,
my dad was kind of crazy, but my whole family was creative. My dad played the trumpet. He also sang. So he played taps like, reveille. He played that, and so that was his job. You know, not that that wasn't, he was like a lieutenant, but you know, obviously they need someone to do it, and he was the one that would do it. But he would also like do that in our room in the morning. He would come in and be like, reveille, reveille, rise and shine. We're like, Dad, we are not in the Navy, stop. But he could sing too. His voice sounded like the guy from The Temptations, always and forever. So he had this very high-pitched, soft voice. And my mom's voice was very like, you know, she sang like Patti LaBelle. So music was just in our house all the time.
Did you guys go to church?
Mm-hmm.
Was there a lot of church music involved in that? Or was it more contemporary music when you're listening in the car? What kind of music were you freestyling over?
So we listened to church
over?
Music on Sundays.
Right. Right.
Getting ready to go to church. You know, he's got us blasting. I listen to a lot more gospel and spiritual music than my parents ever did. My dad wasn't super spiritual. It was my mom. Mm-hmm. My dad was from the north. So Niagara Falls, like more city. And my mom was from the South. And so I always remember my mom's side of the family being way more dominant in my childhood, which consisted of like the farm, you know, family gatherings, music, cookouts, running around in your bare feet, you know, very, very real. I don't know. It just was like when you go to grandma's house, you go to church. You know, it's like we knew that that was going to happen. In our regular everyday life, not so much. We just kind of like chilled on Sundays. And
when did you start writing songs? I mean, eight, you wrote that song and you still remember it. Would you repeat that song a lot? When were you thinking, oh, you know what? I should write verses and a pre-chorus. Did that ever cross your mind?
I never finished that song and that's it. It's just those two bars. But I did, after that, my mom bought me a composition book and I just used to write lyrics in there. And that's one thing about me. This is why if you ever write with me, you cannot lie and say that you wrote more than you actually did. Because if I actually wrote the lyric, I remember the melody and I remember everything that I did. Yeah. If I can't remember, you're probably right. You probably did write that part, you know? But that's just something that I think maybe I've developed that skill over years because I never had music to write to until I was about 16 and I finally got a guitar. But I just used to write lyric and melody all the time. And all I have to do is read the lyric and the melody comes back.
Sure.
So I've had that fight with a couple writers. I'm like, bro.
Does it matter?
It doesn't matter for real. But if you try to make it be a thing.
But if I say, hey, I wrote that, and you're like, nice.
Well, okay, for example, so we won't say names because I think we all know these people and this person knows who they are. I walk into a room. The artist is not there yet. There's a bunch of people in the room. I'm one of those kinds of people that's like, I'm not going to hang around if I'm not supposed to be around. So there's like six people in the room. I'm also not... I'm kind of like a person who's like, just let it be. Like, cool, whatever. I'm not a diva. Like, I'm not going to be like, excuse me, we need to clear the room. Whatever. I'll write in the corner, you know.
Right.
I can write my song in the corner and go in the booth and do whatever I need to do. And you guys, you know, can just be around to see it happen. So artist finally comes in and we're here the whole time. She's whispering in my ear. It's impossible for you to have contributed the same amount as I have because she's whispering to me. And you understand?
Sure.
So at one point, this person does change a word, literally one word.
Yeah.
And it wasn't even the whole word. It was like two syllables. I'm not even being funny. It was like extremity, remedy.
Right.
So we're like, oh, great. The artist liked it. We kept it. Comes time to do splits. The artist, this is an artist, and this is another thing that I don't think a lot of writers pay attention to, is that once you write a song and you get a placement, unless those songs are licensed, unless the album is fully licensed, it may not count towards your pub. So
just to explain what that is, because I don't think people really understand that, who are even professional writers, that even if an album comes out, that if not all the writers agree to their splits from song 1 to 14 or whatever,
even then, on songs you had nothing to do with.
Yeah, totally. Nobody gets paid. They don't release any of the mechanical royalties. So there are some hit albums that have sold 2 million, 3 million copies.
I think I'm allowed to say this. Confessions is one of those albums, for example, where there's disputes.
So as long as there are disputes, people aren't getting paid even on those kinds of albums that are diamond albums. Mm-hmm. And you wrote the song that you're the only writer of. Clearly, you're the only writer. You should get 100%, 9.1 cents per song times 10. That's nine. You know, that's
a lot whatever. Of freaking money.
Yeah, exactly. That's $910,000 just for your, you know, for your publishing on that. It's all sitting in the middle of
a dispute.
Some disputed, you know, bank.
Right. So this artist does not play that.
Yeah.
She licenses her stuff as soon as it comes out. So in an effort not to ruin my relationship, which, by the way, was very smart because me and this artist are very close now, because I'm like, you're not going to ruin my relationship with this amazing, incredible woman because you're, you know, you're greedy. So long story short, we end up getting on the phone because I'm nice. I'm like, I really don't have to talk to her. Cause it is what it is, but I'm gonna be nice. So we're all talking. Long story short, this person goes, I am not settling until I leave with the same amount of publishing as you get. And I'm like, you know, this doesn't really sound like a case of you wanna do what's right. It sounds like an ego thing.
Right.
And because I think the price of this relationship that you are bargaining, it's clear that you didn't do what you think you did, but I'm gonna let you have it because this is the price that you're gonna pay for this relationship. And in the grand scheme of things, I think I made the right decision because that song didn't do what everybody thought it was gonna do. A lot of times the artist that you're working with, if it's a huge artist, it kind of like blinds you and you can't see the bigger picture. And I think that's what happened there. But I always try to tell writers, man, like don't scrape for scraps. Like, don't do that. Don't, like, try to get all you can, because that's the wrong energy to have. You know, like, if it's about being fair, and if it's about, you know, if we're going back and forth in the room and the whole time, even if nothing you said goes into the song, that's a co-write. We're bouncing ideas off each other. But if you sit there in the room the whole time and you might say one or two things and then you want an equal split, now I feel like you're gaming everyone in the room. You know, it can also be a detriment to the song when you have a co-writer who is not responsive or who is just like, no, I don't like it. No, I have that rule. Like, you're not allowed to say no if you don't have a better suggestion, you know. You can just be like,
yeah, be constructive. You can say no as long as you say no, but what about, or how, even if it's
how
a
can
bad
it be better?
Idea, right?
Oh, maybe I think we can beat it. That's Mozilla's favorite thing to say.
Yeah,
no, I think we can beat it. I think we can beat it. Because you always want to be encouraging and forward moving. You know, you never want anyone to feel like their ideas are stupid.
Right.
Sometimes the stupid ideas are the hit ideas.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. For example, Timber. I was just being stupid. I was like literally like, remember, just being an idiot. And Brayon was like, you're laughing, but that's actually pretty dope. I'm like, really? Seriously? All right, fuck it. Let's do it.
I'm going to say two things about that song, which I know we'll get to, but these are important. One is when you say the makeup songs in your house and you're like, you know how you were vacuuming. And
yeah.
All right. So like, I don't know why this is, and you know my pug, Peter. So for whatever reason, around our house, that song was really big right when we got Pete. And we would be like, I got a pug. His name is Peter. He likes to move. He likes to dance. I got a pug.
That's and why like, Peter likes like me
we,
so much.
Yeah, and we move his arms, you know, so he's dancing. And it's like, for some reason, like, I think of Timber. And that song is played in our house, in our heads. It was still now multiple times a week. You know, it's just how it works. So that's one.
I love it.
So that's one. So you get a giant shout out for that. Because I think whenever you write a song that's in the zeitgeist enough where people can change the lyrics to fit their home, that's like that you did something. Like, so
I call that a time capsule record. It's like, I remember being in my living room one time watching So You Think You Can Dance randomly. I never watched that show. But I get a lot of licenses and sync requests. Basically, at people asking for permission to dance to my songs on that show and World of Dance and things like that. Which, by the way, writers, is another way to have a hit song. It's not just on the billboards. If you have a song that is getting heavily synced and licensed, you can recoup your deal. You can, like, make, like, millions of dollars just off of TV and film placements. Like, Worth It was not a huge chart topper. But syncs and licenses, it was in like four movies, like video games, So You Think You Can, I mean, not So You Think You Can Dance, Just Dance, Dance Dance Revolution. At one point, I was getting like three or four requests a week just off of that song. So I think I was watching So You Think You Can Dance, and just randomly, I had like stopped on the channel, and I'm cooking dinner, and the guy on the team was like, if we don't get this pyramid right, they're doing like a pyramid. If we don't get this pyramid right, it's going down. I'm yelling Timber. I was like, oh, rewind it. And I like, you know, recorded. I'm like, this is how you freaking know that you are doing some amazing things. When you are just randomly living your life and people are quoting something that you wrote. Like, this is something that line literally so cool. came from my brain.
Yeah.
And now I'm hearing it back to me.
Weird feedback.
Yeah.
That's the weirdest feedback that you can...
It's so awesome, man, because it just really means like you're tuned in, your vibration is right, you know, it's awesome.
Here's my other story about Timber, is that I think it's the first time I wrote with Mozella was right in the room next door to where you and Brayon were.
At Atlantic?
Yeah. And they... I had hemorrhaged my vocal cord the day before, and I didn't know it yet, but my voice was just so sore, and I was like, something's wrong. And I showed up to this thing, and I was just like, I don't know what I want to, you know, Pitbull's there, and who's a very nice guy.
He's a gentleman.
Super gentleman. Like, he's the kind of artist that shakes hands of all the you know, the assistants and second engineers and stuff, and then waits till he can say thank you to all of them for working for him for that day. So, you know, super nice guy. And I just wanted to go, you know, who wouldn't want to go in a session? And at that time, you're talking about one of the biggest artists in the world, if not, you know, he's Mr. Worldwide. So we get all these tracks, and this one track that they're like, this one's a hit, and there's a harmonica all over it. And there was the song Whistle was a hit. And this is the problem when you chase hits, is that we're sitting in the room trying to write a song where I think we called it Harmonica. And tried to do like something that was like, you know, like,
Timber track?
Yeah, blow my harmonica or something like that, the way that like the whistle thing was an innuendo. Meanwhile, the guy who you know, I'm friends with Brayon too, and he's in the next room who wrote Whistle, is not writing the same song. But I'm sitting there being like, I don't know, this is a great idea. Like, Whistle's big, so then harmonica's got to be big too. Let's just do that. And we're sitting there writing that, and I'm, you know, I'm just like, just remembered writing to this track that I think Miles Beard maybe found it, or was it, I don't remember who found the track. Was it Miles or was Mike Caron? It was someone in that world. And when we got it though, we tried our best. We wrote the wrong thing.
You know, I always find, like, you're right. When I feel like I'm under this intense pressure and I've been A&R'd to pieces, you know, the A&R comes in, he's like, this is what we need. We need another work from home. Yeah. We need, you know, just simple beat with the melody. And da, da, da. I was like, okay. And I've just, over the years, I've learned to translate that into, oh, you want a hit.
Right.
You don't want Katy Perry hot and cold. You want a hit.
Right.
You want what that song produced for you, which is a lot of money.
Right.
But every time I've allowed myself to get sucked in to the energy of other people, you know, like, because they're not creating, right? They don't understand what it is to be that channel. I mean, I'm sure for you, anytime you've ever written one of your crazy, huge hits, you were not thinking about, let me please this A&R. You were thinking, I mean, I don't want to speak for you, but.
No. I mean, literally, it's all been the ones that I was pretty sure were not hits when we wrote them. I think one of them I really liked. The other ones were, could have, you know.
People ask me that all the time. Like, did you know that this song was going to be a hit when you were writing it? And I can't say yes to that. But what I can say is that every song that was a hit for me, I had a lot of freaking fun while I was doing it, yeah. Or I was comfortable.
Yeah.
And I was like not under pressure and I didn't have somebody breathing down my neck. You know, like when you just give me the guitar or give me whatever you're going to give me and leave me alone, let me do what I'm doing. That's the ones that I've had success with.
I think that was, the Timber one was really strange only for me, only because I had never, I guess there was maybe one of two times where I've written to a track where the song became massive. Usually when they're like, this track's a hit, that doesn't mean anything because the song's always the hit.
Right.
The track is just the track. If you want to do music, then it's perfect. Then it can be hit music, but it's not going to be a hit song.
Right.
It's so rare that somebody's able to make a hit song off of an existing track.
As
Savin says, it's like writing a screenplay to special effects.
Yeah.
And I love that. You know, it's really hard to write a hit song to tracks. But did any of your other songs come from that?
No. I mean, like,
it's really just that. Because, for example,
Worth It was like three different songs that I had written to different Stargate tracks, and then they just took the acapellas and chopped them up and made one song. And then, so they took the verses from one and the hook from another and the verse from Kidding from another song. And then they remade a different beat. So that one, I didn't even know. Like, it was like number 10 on iTunes. And I got an email from Mikkel, like, congratulations. I'm like, for what? He goes, for our hit song. I'm like, huh? He's like, it's number 10 on iTunes. So I go look and I see number 10 and I click it and I'm listening and I'm like, okay, this doesn't sound familiar. But then the verse comes in, I'm like, oh, okay, I did write that. I do recognize that. And I'm like, this is crazy. When did this happen? What? You know, I'm sure maybe not a lot of writers have experienced this, but I've had to change my energy around this because for some reason, the majority of my career, songs have come out and I had no idea. I think I just had so many songs out there written with so many people that I would look up and have a placement on Monica and like have no clue that it was even out. It's crazy.
So going backwards, you know, this is 2004 and you're telling younger you that's about to do YouTube, like, yo, trust me, it's going to work out. You know, like, how would you explain to that kid that, like, what their career is going to be like? And what advice do you give to that kid who's about to go put their face all over YouTube?
I would say go watch Behind the Music, every one that you can find, and go watch every documentary and everything that you can find on these people who go into the music industry because it's real. You know, like, you watch those and you're like, oh, that'll never happen to me. No, I'm smarter. No, I'm nice. People, they wouldn't do that. It's real. It really happens. People really do get taken advantage of. People really do get robbed. You know, they really do like go crazy. I had a moment where I was feeling like I was in the Twilight Zone. I mean,
Well, tell me the story. I mean, I made you jump forward with Timber, but there's so much story between getting the deal with Capitol and releasing music and the deal with Warner Chappell. And
yeah, okay, I gotta put my bagel down for
yeah,
this.
Exactly. Welcome to Mornings with Bagels. So let's go from the...
All right, so YouTube. 2004, started uploading videos. They're like crappy Walmart webcam, you know, $24 webcam quality where it's all grainy and you can barely see, like it's all digital. So I'm uploading videos and I think like one blog that's really popular now started posting my stuff. And 2006, you know, it was like 2 or 3 years before I started getting crazy, crazy traffic. But 2006, 2007, I started getting really popular. And when I would upload a video, overnight, I'd get like 10, 20,000 views. So I started attracting the attention of industry professionals. And mind you, this is way before people were going online to find talent. I mean, this was literally like the first, you know, Justin Bieber was about to get a deal like 2 years later. Esme Denters, Marie Digby, you know, these kinds of people. If you are on YouTube and you were watching back then, you know who I'm talking about. I think on the movie Crazy Rich Asians, during the wedding scene, they had a performer. She came from YouTube. She was around I can't remember her name right now, but she's an Asian American woman, and she's amazing. But she started on YouTube as well. So at this time, I think I might have had like 300 videos up. I would come home every day after school, after work, after college. You know, obviously I've evolved. I've started in high school. Now I'm in college and I'm still doing this. And I would upload a video every day. And then my stepfather bought me a guitar. So I started posting my own music. And then eventually I wrote my first full song on guitar, which was Hello My Apple. And that was the song... one of the songs that got me my deal at Capitol Records. At the time, I think it was Chris Anacute or somebody showed my videos to him and he took it to Rob Stevenson or whoever he took it to at the label and they decided they wanted to sign me. There was a couple other people who they were looking at. This was around the Katy Perry Hot and Cold time where they had like Feroz was my label mate as well. A couple other people who... can't remember right now, but I can see their faces clearly, but I can't remember their names. And anyway, signed to Capitol Records immediately. And what's crazy is now in hindsight, I didn't realize that I thought it was my choice signing to Capitol, but really it was like a political thing because at the time, the people who were managing me also were heavily involved in Katie's project. So it was just like take this alley-oop. Because we're gonna do the same thing we did with Katie with her, except for this time we own everything. Same producers, same mixer, same management, same everything. It was crazy. And me being this 18, 19 year old girl from dirt road country, I'm like, yes, I'm signed to Capitol Records.
Were you still living in
Florida? At the time, no, I had moved to Atlanta to live with the people who I signed to, the production company. So I was living in this big house with all these dudes. I was the only girl. One of the guys that was in the house with us was Honorable Cino, who now is like huge super producer in the hip hop world. He produced a couple of songs and helped EP my album that I just put out. So we're still really close. But I was living in this house with all these dudes, 18, 19 years old. And signed to Capitol, making this album that was like pop, folk, you know, kind of had some nuances of what I'm doing now. But my theory back then was like, I could be an asshole and be like, no, this is the album I want to make. Because I really wanted to make like some Corinne Bailey Rae, Fine Frenzy, you know, very like eclectic, Imogen Heap kind of stuff. That's I'm weird like that. Like I used to listen to Panic at the Disco, and like I was the weird black girl that in high school were like, she thinks she white, you know, she's smart, she get A's in school. Like, no, seriously, I used to do people's homework. Like, I would charge $20. Like, that was me. I was the nerdy. I watched anime. Like, that was not cool where I'm from. So going into this music, I really wanted to make some, like, earthy, artsy shit. And that just was not, you know, I just kept hearing, you'll get no money. They'll put no money behind you if it's not pop. It has to be pop. And so I did this thing. And how much of a mind was it yeah. that I'm walking into these places in like Iowa where the song was a pretty much like a hit. I just went back to Iowa 10 years later and there's the line of people like, oh my God, Dollhouse, like I'm singing and they're singing the words. I'm like, this is crazy. This song was really a hit up here. It's like, you know, so I'm going to places like that, Iowa, you know, Kansas, and I'm walking in and they're expecting to see a white girl. So I had places where I walk in and I remember this one grandmother was sitting there with her granddaughter and I walk in and immediately she's like, we're leaving. And the daughter's like, no, you know, she starts crying. That's one place. And then another place, I walk in to the meet and greet and I walk in the conference room with my guitar and everything. And the father's face just immediately turned red and he's like, get your stuff. And like just took his daughter, they left. You know, that happened. And people, wow. you know, they don't want to admit it. Like even now with the country music that I'm doing, and we know that Nashville, there's Darius Rucker, there's Mickey Guyton, there's Chuck Berry, and Darius Rucker are the only two black people hanging up at the Grand Ole Opry backstage. So we know that that's not a space that is predominantly brown. It's just not. So I've had to have this conversation where it's like, look, there's just some spaces where when there's not a lot of people who look like me, it makes people uncomfortable when I show up. So I had to deal with that at 19. I'm walking in. I'm just trying to live my dream. I'm having a great time. I walk into these pop offices in the radio station, and the PD is expecting to see. It's funny because Kesha's TikTok and my song were out at the same time. They thought she was black. They thought I was white.
Whoa.
So when I would walk in, they're expecting to see Kesha. And when she walks in, they expect to see me. Like, yeah. Literally, this is what I was hearing at the radio stations. I would leave, go in the car, turn the radio on to see if they play my song. What'd you think about Priscilla? I thought she was white, you know?
How did that affect you to see? I mean, I don't know. Had you experienced racism before that?
Oh, yeah, in Florida, but it's a little different. It's more like, are you lost, honey? You know, it's more like, you know, everybody gets quiet when you walk in the room and you walk right back out. Or, like, you just don't go over there. Or you see, like, a certain truck with the flag, the Confederate flag. Or you see, like, the Guy Harvey shirts and the, you know, the tight jeans and the mud and boots. And you just like, okay, I know not to go over there. You know, it's just kind of a unspoken thing, whereas they were actually saying it and I was actually seeing it, you know.
Did you feel like the label or your management, once they realized that there was kind of some sort of something of a racist backlash,
they never realized it? No, because I think it's hard when you're not experiencing something or when you believe that it doesn't exist to even acknowledge. You have to acknowledge it first. You know, they just believed that the record didn't work.
Right.
They didn't realize that, no, it's when I show up, they don't want to play it anymore. That's what it is. You know, it's not, there's nothing wrong with the song. If Katie put that out, it would be another hit. But they just didn't want to believe that. They didn't.
So what happened after you released the song?
So we went with a more soulful song next, would have been Lovesick, and we had B.O.B. on it as the feature, and they just didn't put it out. They paid for it and everything, and they just took their hands off. They're like, you know what, the record isn't working. We tested it, it's not working. Yeah, but you're testing it in the same markets, you know, it's an old system. And I think it was like the wheel was like beginning to fall apart at that time. And I was in the transition of like things falling apart. Because right after
that was a really weird time, because that's like piracy at its kind of at its peak, like just when MP3s are big if you're at the top, but there's really no room to, there's not a lot of investment.
Yeah.
Going on in the music business.
I mean, I had they shot a $250,000 video for me. Like, I think I was like right at the end of the big budgets and the big, you know, I had a crazy video effect, special effects in my video, like tiny people, and you know, I was like a giant. It was a cool video, but yeah, it was like right at the tail end of the lights, camera, action. And then that's when EMI was getting sold. So I was in limbo for like 2 years, trying to get off the label. And then I went through like 4 different regime changes where Dan McCarroll came in and, you know, Rob left and, no, Nick Gatfield left, Rob took over, then Dan McCarroll, then Ron Fair. And Ron Fair is an old friend. So he is the one who, he gave me my first placement, and I met him when I was 17. Had my first music industry experience with him. So he helped me get off Capitol Records. And he basically was like, well, don't let her drown here. Just let her go. Like, you're not going to do anything with it. You don't know what to do. Just leave her alone. And I made 3 albums that never came out. And this final one was like more of like a soulful R&B one, and which I loved, by the way. And
were you doing that because that's what you wanted to release at the time? Or were you doing it? Yeah.
I mean, I wanted to, like, this was before, you know, R&B and hip hop became the number one genre. It just felt like the right thing to do at the time, which I'm glad I didn't, because I think it's, you know, I hate to say this, but I think once you go into the R&B realm, it's very difficult to depart from. It's very difficult to go do pop. It's difficult to go and make a country record. You can come from almost any other genre and do R&B. But once you do that, it's very difficult to go anywhere else. Yeah. So I'm glad I didn't do that. Even though the songs were amazing, like Fantasia ended up with a song, When I Met You, that was going to be my first single. Ended up giving that away to her.
How did it feel to have her sing it?
Well, it didn't feel any kind of way because, I mean, I was happy. Ron asked me for it because normally I wouldn't have if it was a song for me. I don't shop those records unless I really love the artist and I like really feel like they're going to do okay with it. Because there's just some songs that are not for sale.
Right.
It's like, this is my story. I'm not giving this to you because I didn't write it for that purpose, you know?
Sure.
I'd rather have it sit than have somebody sing my story, you know, and it's not right.
Right.
I mean, I've only had like 2 songs come out that I didn't want the artist to sing it.
I so bad want to ask you.
I don't want to insult the artist.
No, that's fine.
I love this artist and it wasn't her fault.
Sure.
It was the producer that was the
song. When did you start writing for other people?
Was when the label then? Fell apart, when things at the label started falling apart, I went on tour with
Akon. Were you signed to Warner Chappell already at that point?
I've been signed to Warner my whole music existence. Yeah. So from
2008. How did you meet Ryan?
He actually, and I don't know if he will admit this or if how true this actually is, but he got hired after our first meeting. So he was not at Warner Chappell when I first started. He came on to Warner to be
Scott Francis was the head of it. Yeah.
So he came on to Warner to be my person. Blue Hamilton was my
Blue right.
Yeah, but he didn't pay attention to me at all.
Well, he went to pursue music.
Yeah,
he went to pursue being a songwriter.
He didn't give a shit about me.
Yeah,
at all. Like, it was so funny because we had the same last name. My maiden name is Hamilton.
Oh, wow.
So we had this thing. I was like, yeah, you're my cousin, whatever. But then, like, nothing. Yeah. Like, we had this big meeting. It was like Greg Souders and like Blue.
And Brad Aarons was there at the time. And
yep.
Yeah. This is before Big John and Katie.
Oh, Jason Boyarsky. So, yeah, Jason and Scott, they signed me. And the energy was crazy. Like, everybody was so happy. We're like, yes, this is awesome. And then nothing. like not Jason or Scott, like they were awesome. And so Ryan came in to be my person. And then immediately we just like started grinding. Like I remember I met him in New York after a Regina Spektor concert. And I forced him to eat a piece of my carrot cake. Like, he didn't want to eat it. I'm like, it's really good, Ryan. Here, take it. He's like, no, I'm good. I'm like, eat the freaking cake. it was awkward, I admit now. I was an awkward child. Anyway, after that, like, we just kind of hit the ground running. We would talk every day. Like, he would be the first person I talked to and the last person I talked to at night. Like, yo, what's up? What we doing today? Da, 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 da. Okay, well, what'd you do today? Who'd you work with? Da, 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 whatever. And we just would, like, he would work the shit out of me. Like, I would be doing at least 5 sessions a day at one point, 2 songs in each session. Just, I remember one day I had the whole street at Glenwood. So I had both rooms at Encore and all the rooms, I think like 4 or 5 rooms at Glenwood.
And he would just go and be like, right, next one. Right,
I was working with Melanie one, right. Fiona and Salam in one room, Jean-Baptiste on like some Beyonce stuff that never placed in another room, Jesse McCartney in another room. And then I had like Akon in another room and just like a random session in the other room. Just like literally running from room to room, like, cool, you got the, okay, you're going to cut that? All right, I'll be right back.
Were you cool not being the artist at that point?
At that time, it was fun. That's what I'm saying. The energy was fun.
Yeah.
I like music and I like creating. And sometimes there are things that I need to express my stories as an artist. And sometimes there are things that just need to be heard by the world and they need a vessel that is not me. Because some things I'm just not going to say. And I'm not a dancer like that either. So, like, if I write a fucking dance song, I'm not going to be like, this is for me. Like, I know there was a rumor going around about that. Like, she's trying to keep every song for herself. But that's like me coming in your house and trying to take one of your guitars and be like, why are you trying to keep all these guitars for yourself? You know, it's like, it's yours. It belongs to you. It doesn't belong to anyone else until you say, here, you know, have this.
Don't take my guitars.
I mean, they're pretty awesome.
Yeah, thank you.
Pretty awesome axes over there. But no, I've never been jealous,
yeah,
to not have, because that's odd, right? That's an odd perspective to have, that I would be jealous of something I create.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
What's the first song that you really realized the difference between? You have a record deal, and record deals seem like the goal until you have a record deal. And then you finish the record deal and you realize that was never the goal. This is what 90% of the people who get signed go through on some level. You know, just that the record deal is not the point.
Right.
It's what you aim for when you're younger, because
that's what everybody tells you.
Yeah, it's sort of what you know, but it's not the thing to aim for. I think once you see a song really travel around faster than you can, that's when you realize the weight of what music really is. Mm-hmm. And I assume that's the Rihanna song. Is that the first one that really kind of like
actually what's funny is I just had this realization maybe like last year, and it was with Timber. And I went to Bali for a writing camp, and it was incredible. Peter Cotillard and, you know, Oak,
Yeah.
Hosted it. Incredible. It was an amazing time. Like, awesome. And me being the big dork that I am, and like Mother Teresa and I share the same birthday. So, which is in like 7 days. And oh, so
happy early birthday.
Thank you.
Or late birthday by the time this comes out.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. Thanks. I'll be aged by the time you guys hear this. But yeah, so I was like, I really want to use my day off, my last day in Bali, to go to the orphanage. And so we went, and so the kids were in school. It was basically all the kids were not there. Some of the kids that were able to go to school were at school, but the disabled children were still there. And so that's who we were visiting with. And when I, you know, I took my guitar, and, you know, I wanted to like film me interacting with the kids and like singing with them and doing some music things. It didn't really turn out how we thought it would, but we still filmed it anyway. I thought I was going to be able to like teach some of the kids how to play or whatever, and capture that kind of thing. But long story short, I end up singing Timber, and immediately they start clapping and they are singing the words. And I'm like, wait, y'all can't even speak English. This is crazy. And you're supposed to be mentally disabled, supposed to be, but you're not. You are singing these words. Let anybody tell it, these kids are unintelligible. But they're singing these words and they're clapping and they're happy. And I'm like, this is crazy, because music is able to reach not only through a perceived mental barrier or a handicap or a disability, but a language, you know. And the other thing is, this was in a remote village. Like, we had to literally walk through back alleys and drive through the bushes to get to this place. But they're singing the words. And these kids aren't that old either. They're like 5. So I'm like, yo, this is crazy.
For like, a kid from Florida to be communicating
in Bali,
with people
Indonesia, in Bali, which is like an 18-hour journey from Los Angeles. And it just blew my mind. I was like, wow.
Why did you start working in country music?
It's just so easy for me to write a country song.
Why?
It just is. It's a story. It's like, I mean, it's just like, I don't know. Every song I've ever written is a country song. Timber's country. California King Bed is country. It got Rihanna on the, I want to say AMAs or something like that with Sugarland. She sang it. Literally every song I've ever written is in the country format style. Just the song. When you strip away all the instrumentation and all that other stuff, you can just play it with a guitar or a piano, and it's a story.
Do you feel like Nashville, because you were alluding to it on some level before, I mean, obviously it's not particularly racially diverse, certainly on the charts, and it seems like it's maybe in the last couple of years it's starting to have more women on the charts, but it was obviously a really male-dominated industry in the last 5 years. Do you feel like working with Miranda Lambert or pursuing what you've been pursuing as an artist, that they're accepting and that they're excited to have you there?
I think good music transcends all judgment. And I think we're living in a time where I don't have to ask permission from any of the gatekeepers in Nashville. I mean, if I want to get my stuff on radio, maybe, and there's different ways that people can try to hold back the flood, so to speak. But there's so many people out there, man, that love country music. I just did the Bill Pickett Rodeo this summer, which is a black rodeo. And literally, I mean, there's dudes out there with full body tattoos, baggy jeans, cowboy boots, buckle, and a hat. Like, this dude looks like he is straight out of Compton, but he's a cowboy. There's a whole market of people who are like, oh my God, why haven't we had a black Carrie Underwood? Like, people were buying my CDs left and right, just coming out of the thing like, oh my gosh, is this you? Were you the one out there singing? Yeah, let me get two of those. So I think there's a whole untapped market, but I think the difference between my music and a lot of maybe artists of color in the country space, before me is that I'm actually bringing my culture with me when I write. It's not like I can't lay on the bed of a truck and look at the stars because without somebody coming up to me and asking me, what am I doing?
Wow.
So I'm not going to write about that. But I am going to write about, you know, the backyard or the cookout, you know, that you don't hear those kinds of stories on country radio. You hear walking through the park or those are not things that I do. So I don't drink beer, drink Hennessy. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But or like.
But it's not that that's confined to you. It's the massive demographic in the South.
Well, I'm just wondering, like, yeah, where do you think all those brown people went after emancipation? Do you think they just went poof? No, they still live there. You know, they still live in the same area as you while you're listening to your country music and flying, walking around with your Confederate flag flying. They're still brown people in that space. Just visually, when you think about Nashville, you don't think black people. I have to admit, when I went, I was surprised. I was like, oh, there's black people here.
Somebody said this when I first went to Nashville. It was one of the first times that I had spent serious time in the South because I toured through the South in a band, but you're one day new city, you know, maybe 2 days in one city, mm-hmm, but it's pretty quick, you know? And going to Nashville, I was assuming that coming from the North, that the South would be still very segregated. And somebody said this to me, that the South has been forced one way or the other to try to, in a lot of places, certainly in Nashville, where there's been some effort to integrate in the really municipal parts, like the really urban areas, versus where I grew up in Chicago, where there is a clear line where north of this line is white and south of this line is black. And it's almost more segregated in parts of the North where
you just don't go on that part. Side what? Of town. You just don't go on that.
Yeah,
side
and
of town.
I don't know why even LA, like there, LA, the parts of LA, you don't see the fact that 46%.
I think that's a little systemic, though, because like honestly, when you think about real estate, and you think about job opportunities, and you think about things like that, like I don't know, music has allowed me a certain privilege. Where when I go home, I could stay closer to my parents, but the hotels in that area are not nice. They're cheap. They're just not nice. I can go to the beach where I'm paying $300 a night, you know, to stay at Gloria Estefan's hotel, but that's 15 minutes away from my parents. And it's across a bridge, across the railroad track. You know, it's just different. Whereas like here, if I want to go and be around people who look like me, I have to drive an hour from where I live, which is Calabasas. You know, it's a quiet neighborhood. We don't have any, like after 9 o'clock, it's literally quiet. You can hear the dogs barking and the birds chirping. There's no trash on the street. Like it's an amazing neighborhood. But if I want to go, and there's no one who looks like me, even my neighbor makes a joke about like the property value going down because we live there, despite the fact that my house is the nicest one in the neighborhood. You know, like, so things like that where it's just like black people just don't live in the nice areas. They live in the cheap areas. That's just the thought process. And it's actually, if you think about it, it's true. You know, there's not very many people who look like me in the places that I've lived. Even out here, I had a penthouse in Sherman Oaks. I was the youngest and I was the only black person in the building. I lived in Glendale in a very, very nice apartment complex before it started, like, it was a condo before it started getting gross in that area. The youngest and one of two black families in the building. You know, it's not just a statistic, it's a reality where systemically the places that people who look like me can afford are in areas that are not so nice. Like even my pastor lived in Compton, in Inglewood area for a very long time because that's what they could afford with three kids.
You know? There was an actor friend of mine who has become really successful in the last few years who he's from Oakland, and he was talking about survivor's guilt. You know, he's a musician, mm-hmm. he's a rapper, he's a an actor, really successful, and talks about
feeling bad, like you left feeling people bad behind.
He writes about, he just had a movie come out where that's really honest about growing up in Oakland, and it's not pretty, you know? I mean, he's bringing his past with him, but it's interesting, the idea of, I think a lot of artists, regardless of their race, have some sort of survivor's guilt when they become somewhat successful, because mm-hmm. everyone becomes successful on their own time, and yeah. everyone has a different definition of success and all the other things. But financially speaking, you know, it's so sink or swim in this business. Do you feel any survivor's guilt?
I'm glad you asked that, because I've kind of been having like a recap of my life recently, and I think it's because I'm reaching like a milestone birthday. I'm going to be 30 this year. And
congratulations.
Thank you. I look at it as freaking awesome. Like, I'm like, oh, yes, yeah. Just I'm wait an adult.
The day you turn 30, all of a sudden people are like, wow, I trust you.
Yes.
It's so weird because they're like, you made it.
Yeah.
If you can make it to 30 in the music business, it means you didn't give up. It means that something went your way.
I mean, I started when I was 18. Yeah. So to still be like, I mean, I've had a hit every year since I started. Even the year, 1 year, I only had one song. It was a hit. It was the Carrie Underwood Miranda song. So it's like I've actually, and I just recently went back and looked. Like, you know, P, like you should really not be complaining about anything, because you have had, even with all like the tumult in your life or the perceived hardships that you've had, you really have been doing well. And so I said all that to say, like, coming from where I come from and my humble beginnings, I mean, like, literally growing my own food and going outside to pick oranges off the tree if I wanted something to drink, like, that kind of thing. There have been times where I felt bad, where I felt like I've got to go back and help, which is why I have always been very involved with ASCAP and, like, advocacy and doing the expo as often as I can and teaching and trying to, like, drilling into people's heads. But what I have come to realize is that whenever I was having a bunch or a multitude of success, it was when I was happy, carefree, when I was vibrating at like the highest level of just like, I'm happy to be alive. I'm happy for existence. I'm happy that I don't have to sit behind a desk every day. I'm happy that I didn't waste 4 years in college. You know, not saying that if you don't, you know, if you go to college, that's great. But my parents tried to force me to go, and I almost let them. And so I'm glad I did not do that. I'm glad I followed my heart. And I've come to realize that everything bad that has ever happened to me, it's because it was like, that's a raven, self-fulfilling prophecy. Oh my God, I just really don't want him to cheat on me. Oh my God, I just hope they're not stealing from me. You know, like, every time something happened, it's because I brought it into my situation with my thoughts. And nobody wants to really admit that. Like, well, I got in a car accident. Dude, you drew that. I'm sorry. Like, all the car accidents that I've been in, and thank God I haven't been in any in recent years. But when I think about the events leading up to it, dude, I brought that into my situation. So I've had some pretty awful things happen to me in my life. People take advantage of you mentally, physically, you know, emotionally. All of those things I brought on myself. And the same way I brought those negative things, you asked earlier, how do you go from dirt road town in Florida to Hollywood and writing and being friends with, you know, people who you used to watch on TV? I drew that into my experience as well. I didn't have any contacts in the music business. I didn't know anyone. I didn't know that 10 years from, you know, when I started on YouTube, that I would have number ones and be traveling around the world to places like Indonesia and London and France writing. songs for other people and performing in front of 30,000, 80,000, however many people that performed in front of in arenas and stadiums. I had no idea. But I continued to put that energy out there and I continued. And this is for anyone. When you're talking about survivor's guilt, that what you are doing is taking on other people's issues. You're taking on the fact that that person doesn't have as much as you have and you feel bad for them. But what you really should be doing is encouraging that person and putting light and hope into that person and telling them, hey, you could be anything you want to be, man. Like, it's really difficult when you are in a community that is constantly, every time I go home, I have to tell my parents, like, mom, dad, I'm sorry. I have to stay in a hotel. I can't be around all this. I try not to say negative energy. I try to phrase it like I need to be in a positive environment because culturally, in where I'm from and in like those small towns, not even just like it's a black or white thing, but in small towns, people, oh, so-and-so died today. Oh, you know, my back hurts. Oh, you know, such and such daughter got pregnant. It's like, it's just like bad news.
Yeah.
Bad news bears. And when you're passing that around, it's just a big tornado of negativity and you just, it's a cycle. And nobody's saying, oh my God, you know, my check was $20 extra this week. Or oh, I got a full tank of gas. Like nobody's talking like that down there. So it's really difficult. You know, if everybody looked at me like I was crazy. My boss, when I worked at a barbecue restaurant, he used to be a tour manager. I told him I was going to make it big in the music industry. He's like, good luck with that. I'm petty. So I went back and I was on Queen Latifah and it was airing that day. And I went back and I turned the TV at the bar to it. And I didn't say anything. I just was drinking my sweet tea. And I'm like, hey, Brian, come here. He's like, what? What's up? And I pointed at the TV and I was like, look, who's that? And he's like, holy shit, that's you. Oh man, that's awesome. And like, he completely forgot about all the negative things that he had said to me before. But I don't think people can help it when you're in that blender every day, you're hearing negativity and it becomes a part of the fabric of who you are and how you talk and how you even perceive the world. So now I don't feel guilty. I feel an obligation to share and to help people wake up and to help them become aware. You know, you hear people like they win their Grammys and they get on stage and they're like, believe in yourself. You can do anything. And it sounds so cliche.
No, but it's true. If you've had a little bit of success selling air for a living, you can relate to it.
Exactly.
The final scene of Hoop Dreams, you know, Hoop Dreams? It's like a documentary in the 90s of these two high school basketball players in Chicago that, you know, want to go pro. And amazing documentary about living on the South Side and being a world-class athlete from junior high forward. But one of them, the end of the movie, he says something along the lines of, you know, people always ask me if I'll remember them when I get to the next level. And I always want to ask them, will you remember me if I don't? And, you know, so many people in this industry are driving for a recognition from people who won't remember you.
That is so true.
And, you know, my first priority is always going to be my wife, you know, and that's just what it is. If she needs me, she comes first.
It's interesting you say that because I think no one's
going to remember whatever song I write next.
Yeah.
But my wife's going to remember.
Half the time they don't even know what you wrote. They just know that you have hits.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I think you mentioned your wife. I think me getting married was another huge pivot for me because I was one of those people who was looking for recognition from, I mean, I thought I had friends. I thought, oh my gosh, this person loves me. No, they don't. They just want the photo op. You know, they just want the opportunity for somebody to be like, oh, you know, P? You know, because I was a very, as extroverted as I am. I still am, but I've learned to like temper it. I mean, I used to wake up and have random people on my couch. Like, that's how...
Way too extroverted.
Yeah. That's yeah. how nice... I mean, yeah. literally, people right. knew that my door... They knew which door was unlocked
yeah.
to come into my house and sleep. And, like, that's not even an exaggeration. Like, I woke up one morning and B. Howard was on my couch. I don't know if you know who that is, but that's, like, the guy that looks like Michael and talks like him and says that he's his son, like, his unacknowledged son. Just Google it. B. Howard. But he was on my couch one day. I'm like, what the
fuck? This, so weird.
This is, he's like, hi, Priscilla. But, yeah, like, getting married. I got married at 26. I was like... Wow, I only need to care about this person. This is awesome. I don't have to care whether or not you're my friend or whether or not you're upset because I didn't let you, you know, come to my house or drive my car. You know, I was so nice, Ross, like unbelievably nice. I would give people shoes, cars, clothes, like, here, take my car. Oh, it's fine. I'll get a ride.
You think they were taking advantage of you?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That was the rumor about me. Priscilla's so nice, she'll give you anything. Like, when I heard that, it actually hurt. I was like, oh. You know, like, normally, like, you know, if I had heard, like, oh, she's a slut, I probably would have been like, oh, whatever, because it's not true. But it was so true that I was just, like, this gullible cesspool of just, like, here. Take publishing. Take my house.
There's another expression that's, if you don't prioritize your life, someone else will.
That was me for yeah. a long time. I mean, but I was so happy that I was not in college or behind the desk because I had had those jobs before.
Yeah.
I worked at a CVS distribution center in a warehouse, clocking in at 7, clocking out at 5. You know, I did that at 18. I was like the boss of people and I hated it. I was like, this is terrible. I don't want to eat cup noodles every day.
We're going to go to the next segment, which is going to... First of all, we didn't even talk about half the songs that you've done. So, you know, just to give a quick shout out to a couple of them. You know, this last year, obviously, Love So Soft for Kelly Clarkson's a really big record. But going backwards, you know, just having... The Carrie Underwood and Miranda Lambert record. You've had so many big songs, and to be honest, I think Worth It being the song that kept Fifth Harmony alive. There's no Work From Home if there's no Worth It. If Worth It didn't happen, that band is in my opinion, they're done. But they'd been looking for hits, releasing songs that were not hits over and over again. You know, I know Joe had a record with them. They've had records that were legit records that just didn't really react, and Worth It really reacted. So, you know, you helped define them, and I imagine that they should be very thankful for where that comes from. But we're going to do the segment 5 for 5, where I'm going to list 5 things, and you tell me the first things that come off your top of your head.
Geez,
we're going to go with... First, a good friend of ours, Breon Isaac.
Breon is crazy, okay? I have never met somebody with a more twisted mind. I mean, you know Breon?
He makes me so happy, it hurts. Like, he's
fantastic. A rare person.
Yeah, I hope he's listening to this.
I hope so, too. He's, like, so unexpected. Yeah. He's like, you know, if you get a have a toasted marshmallow and then you break it open... And there's like meth inside.
It's so good.
That's Breon.
Okay, let's do somebody's got a crazy style. Ron Fair.
Oh my gosh, pimp, OG.
Ron Fair is an A&R guy who signed people like Christina Aguilera back in the day, right?
Yeah, his plaques would cover this entire room, floor to ceiling, no space. Yeah.
And going back, you know, Breon is 5 to 10 number one songs and also just a cool dude. I'm going to do a city, Nashville.
Shrimp and grits, biscuits, and amazing, amazing, talented, and this is not an insult, bar musicians.
The best bar musicians in the world.
Their bar musicians and songwriters are better than some of the best people in L.A., I mean, you can go into any random bar and hear a ridiculously good song.
Performed impeccably.
By a random person who doesn't even want to be in the industry.
Yeah.
They just do it because they love it.
They love it.
It's crazy.
Stargate.
Oh, Stargate. Hit Factory.
Yeah. And they did the same thing for Same Old Love, which we've talked about, and other ones that Worth It happened, where it was, you know, they have this ability to hear hit songs and not be precious about any of the production, throw away everything, start over, move things around until they make it a hit, and then mm-hmm. they make it a hit, and you the next time you hear it, it's not what you left with.
Yeah, they definitely have a formula.
Yeah.
I mean, not very many people have that. Like, I think Max Martin has
They have their formula.
They have their formula that works for them.
Yeah.
You know, don't try to do what they do because only they can do that.
Yeah, they're brilliant. I got to go with Ryan Press. We have to do it.
Oh, gosh. Pain in my butt. No, honestly, Ryan and I have had a very long... There's not very many people in this business that I can say that I've known for 10 years and still talk to them. So he's one of those people. We've definitely had our ups and downs, but I think some people, man, you just kind of like tied to. Like, I think we're sewn together. I don't think, even if we don't work together, I think our stories are just meshed. And I think we had a time where we really did a lot of good things together, and I think both of us were able to build our careers off of each other. So,
yeah. What's advice? I mean, you've given a lot of advice for up-and-coming writers, and I think you can kind of lump this into advice you would have given younger you, you know?
I followed this advice, so I would say read. Read a lot and always keep searching. Never think that you have all the information. Always keep reaching, you know, into the ether, like, what more can I know? And if you have a question, if something doesn't feel right, and this was something that was confirmed for me by Stevie Wonder... if it doesn't feel right, it probably isn't. And if the answer doesn't satisfy you, it's probably because it's BS. So continue to ask and continue to seek answers until you get something that satisfies you. And if somebody is hesitant to answer your question, then, you know, there's probably something up. Never feel obligated to keep quiet. You know, ask the questions. You have a right to know what kind of deals you signed. You have a right to know what your commitments are. You have a right to know what people are expecting of you. Ask.
The worst thing is that you find out the truth and you say no, but think sometimes people want to avoid the truth so bad that they're willing to not ask the question, sign the deal, and walk away knowing that they got screwed somehow, but they don't want to know. They'll just find out someday. When they find out... They're never happy. You're better off knowing up front how you're getting screwed and deal with it ahead of time. And so that way, as you're getting screwed, you're like, screw it. I signed this and I got to deal with the consequences. But whatever positive came in your life came because of this deal, and to say that these offset each other and are balanced.
You know, one thing that I always hated, and I'm so glad that I've like shaken it off now, is this thing that you have to be on your best behavior, right? Because you're in the music business. But this is the most informal, unprofessional profession where like you're in a pub company and they're having a party on Friday and they're drinking beer, you know, at the inside the office. But yet you go in there and they expect you to like mind your P's and Q's and have your hands crossed. Like, no, screw that. Be yourself. Be who you are when you're with your friends. Talk to these people how you would talk, you know, to your brother or to whoever. Like, I don't care if this is the CEO of the company. Be like, yo, man, check this out. This is what I was thinking. You don't have to be like, so, you know, I put together this declaration. No, bro. That's the wrong approach. And when you're trying to be in this business, be who you are. You can't try to be professional because, as I said, this is the most unprofessional profession. So the more well-behaved you are, the less of a star you are. That's the funny part. Yeah. It's like, if you're not jumping on tables, and I'm not saying do this if this isn't, you know, who you are, if that's not how you're feeling at the time. But if you're not jumping on tables and banging shit and like tearing up hotel rooms and you know, putting on a show all the time, normally people tend to overlook you, which is why people like Tekashi and all, you know, all these artists are... Azealia Banks get so much attention because that's quote unquote star quality. So
yeah, it's either that or write your way out of it too. I mean, there's a way to probably write and be a rebel by the way you write, or there's a way, you know, it's the same thing with even a Bon Iver or Kanye.
Yeah, but then you also
too.
Have to be the artist.
Well, yeah,
because that's the thing. Like, I've written so many edgy records and people want to cut them, but then they're like, oh, but can we edit this part? I'm like, that's the thing
that's
that made
part.
You want to cut
yeah,
the song.
Right. Because they get scared.
Absolutely.
Yeah, they get scared. Well, thank you for doing this. You're very smart and you're wise. And, you know, a lot of times we do talk a lot about songs, but I want people to hear real humans talk about humanity in the music business, because what both of us have talked a lot about is the future of what we're doing, and that just because the system was set up this way doesn't mean it always has to stay this way, and that we can change how the industry perceives songwriters and how songwriters can take control of their future and take control of the decisions they're making. And you've always been vocal and you've been an advocate for songwriters to do what's right for themselves. You're not shy. That's not like, I don't think, you know, you've said a couple times that you think people perceive you a certain way. I perceive you as somebody who's not shy, who says what she wants. And
that's because I like you, and you've seen my real side. Most people don't.
Well, I like your real side, and I applaud you in your career, and I know you're just starting. And
thanks.
I also just sent you a new mix of a song that we did in Vegas, because I forgot to send it to you before, so don't fault me, but it's really good.
No, it's cool. I'm listening to it on
really
my Uber
good.
Ride.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I did want to just leave everybody with this, man. Like, you know, I know you've been super involved in the MMA, the Music Modernization Act, in an epic way, you know, just like forcing people to pay attention. And I'm like, applaud the crap out of you for your approach and how you've like made it cool to fight for this, because it wasn't cool, you yeah. know, a couple of years ago when we first started, people were like, what, you're going to Washington D.C. for what, you know, this yeah. is, are we writing songs there?
Right.
But, you know, I believe it was Albert Einstein said that a problem can't be solved from the same plane on which it's created. And I think that the way we're going about it now, yeah, you know, it's definitely been a fight and it's worked to a certain extent. But I really believe that songwriters, producers, anybody who's composing who would benefit from the revision of the music modern, you know, of the copyright law, I think we have to have the gonads to unplug from this yeah. system. You cannot say Warner Chappell, Universal, Spotify, you suck, but
and then not
on Tuesdays,
anything.
I'm listening. Right. You know, I'm still getting my check from you.
That's right.
You have to be willing to lose that. You have to be willing to be like, this is what I'm fighting for, guys. And if you don't want to, if you want to drop me, all right, that's fine. That's cool. You know, you have
next
to take
step
that step.
Next step is going to be, you know, we've got healthcare. We've got things that songwriters are going to have to fight for. We're one of the few artists in the world that are not protected in any sort of union.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if we'll create a union or a guild, but I know one thing is for sure is that
I was looking
this
into
next
it.
This next fight is going to be is that you know, by the time this gets aired, we'll know what the Music Modernization Act has done. But there will be more money in the music industry, and there's no excuse anymore for them not to, them being these companies, to not help provide healthcare, at least basic healthcare, to the creators that are keeping them in business.
I think we should use the Trump administration as an example. A lot of people chose him and chose that side because they thought it was going to be profitable.
Yeah.
And I think after a year or two, they realized that maybe they made the wrong choice. And I think if you choose
yeah.
the side of profitability, money changes in value. The dollar, you know, the value of a dollar changes. But creativity and like invention and ingenuity, that comes every time there's a new birth of a new person and a new desire for somebody who was not in music to come into music. There's an opportunity. You know, if I write a song, Timber, we wrote in like 20 minutes. That song generated millions of dollars. So if I can do that over and over and over in an hour, there's more opportunity from a creative standpoint to be profitable than it is to bank on what's already there. Yeah. And that's just, you know, pick the right side. Don't think about what's available now. Think about what's out there.
We're going to, this generation is already, you know, a little more communal. And I get the feeling that now that the people who are running these other record labels are of the same generation, I think that we're more likely to find solutions that take care of the community as a whole. And let's go change the world.
Let's do it.
All right, thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of And the Writer Is. If you want to hear music from this songwriter I just interviewed, be sure to check out our Spotify playlist or visit our website at andthewriteris.com. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe to us. You can also like us on Facebook and Twitter. And the Writer is produced by Joe London, edited by Miles Bergsma, and published by Big Deal Music. A special thanks to David Silverstein from Mega House Music and Michael White. Until next time, this is Ross Golan.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.